As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Happy Saturday to you. I am Ben Ennis. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live with Jeff Simmons and Ryan Dixon of Sportsnet Magazine. Lots to get to today. Talk Leafs, talk about the goings-on around the National Hockey League, including some trade rumors surrounding Eric Staal and the possibility of Maple Leafs being heavily involved in that. Also, World Series game number one going on Tuesday. Giants and Kansas City Royals, as we all knew it would. With those two teams, a couple of wild card teams. Also, get some news out of the National Football League. Big trade out of the NFL, which doesn't happen all that often. All coming your way in the next couple of hours before noon. But let's start with the Maple Leafs, who lose yesterday in the first half of a home-and-home with the Detroit Red Wings at the Air Canada Center, 4-1. Leafs now 2-3-0 as the Red Wings get over 500 at 2-1-1. Not great. Not a whole lot going on offensively for the Maple Leafs. Mike Santorelli did score in that third period. It was actually a game at that point, but not a whole lot else going on for this Maple Leafs team. Jake Gardner drew back into the lineup. He wasn't great. Stefan Robida was the healthy scratch yesterday, and James Reimer got the start. Hard to blame him too much. Gave up 4 goals on 35 shots, but no doubt, that is the overriding storyline surrounding this team as we are now 5 games into the regular season. And yes, as much as Randy Carlyle doesn't want to address it or even acknowledge that it exists, this team is once again in the middle of a goalie controversy. They don't have a number one. It's pretty clear. Jonathan Bernier is going to get the start tonight, we all imagine, in Detroit. As I mentioned, the back end of back-to-backs against the Red Wings. But when you thought it would be Bernier to just take the ball and run with it at the beginning of the season because he played so well before going on to that road trip in California and getting hurt, the Leafs fell off a cliff, you thought he'd be the unquestioned number one. Jeff, it's just not the case.
Not at the start of the season. Bernier came out of the gate really slow. He had a really rough first 2 games of the season. But I still think he's a number one goalie, and I think it's a pretty small sample size to just assume that he's no longer number one. They don't really have one. Despite Reimer's played a little better so far. But I think Bernier, he'll get the start tonight. And I think he still has a chance to run with it, and I still think he's the kind of guy who could be a number one goalie in this league. He just needs to show more consistency.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's still what they envision. I was actually a little surprised that they went with Reimer for the third game in a row, even though I know, obviously, Bernier was 0-2 and Reimer was 2-0, but you know, the sure sign of when a coach hasn't decided who his number one is you play the guy who got the last W. And I thought it might have sent a little bit of a message to Bernier that, you know, you are our guy. Had they started him Friday night against Detroit. And of course, I mean, that would have, you know, he's now been off for a week. So,
yeah.
I tend to agree with Jeff that, and it would surprise no one if Bernier turned in a 37-save performance tonight and the Leafs squeaked out a 3-1 win with an empty netter, and all of a sudden you would be saying, well, that formula that is maybe great for the Leafs but can get them some Ws, you know, you see a return to that. And, I think there, you know, there's certainly still an opportunity for him after a couple bad starts to right the ship. And, I think largely he's still viewed as the goalie who's going to be the guy.
Aren't we sleeping a bit on James Reimer, though? This is a guy who was a big reason why they were in the playoffs and took the Boston Bruins to 7 games a couple of years ago. Now, say what you will about the final 12 minutes of that Game 7, and maybe some of it can be placed at James Reimer's feet. But you look at the overall numbers, 5-on-5, save percentage, James Reimer, Jonathan Bernier, they're very comparable. And remember, Jonathan Bernier, while we thought that he would be more than capable of carrying the load as the team's number one goalie last year, he hasn't really done it for an entire season. Didn't do it in L.A., and because of an injury, didn't do it last year either. So aren't we a little quick to just say, well, obviously, you know, Jonathan Bernier is going to get back to being Jonathan Bernier, and he's going to take over the number one job. James Reimer is not horrible, despite the fact that he wasn't great at the end of last season, Ryan.
Yeah, it's a curious case. The curious case of James Reimer, no doubt. I mean, even when you go back to when the Leafs traded for Bernier in the summer of 2013, you could make a very solid case that they were trading for Bernier to bump the guy who was their team MVP, you know?
Right.
Like, there's basically not much debate that he was the most valuable player on that team that got into the playoffs in the lockout shortened season. You know, I guess I think about it in a different context, and I think if I'm another NHL team out there and I need a goalie, can I trade for James Reimer and go, well, problem solved, you know, we got our number. Like, I don't think anyone's really thinking that. And I think with Reimer, it's all sort of like, it all depends on what the circumstances are, i.e. when, you know, people talk about him in the context of like being the guy, being the number one, there's a tendency to say, you know, well, he's not quite that good, or now that he's had this chance, he's not quite there. But if he can be the plucky underdog guy, all of a sudden you're going, oh, that Reimer, he's a battler.
I kind of think of him as the guy that kind of crumbles under the pressure, right? Like late in a game seven, or goes into Winnipeg for the first time, his home province, and gets shelled by the Jets and has to be pulled. I think of him as a guy who can do, you know, pretty well during the course of a regular season. You mentioned the lockout shortened year. He was maybe the team MVP. But I kind of feel like he, and maybe it's just confirmation bias because I think of those certain games, but I think of him as almost weak mentally, Jeff, and maybe that's not fair.
No, it's hard to disagree with you, considering, look at last year. He didn't handle that backup role very well at all. And when the Leafs needed him at the end of the season, that was the worst he's ever played in a Leaf uniform. And that kind of speaks to your point. And back to what Ryan said, I think it was pretty telling that no one in the league went after him because everyone knew.
Yeah.
There were rumblings that he asked for a trade.
There's no way he wanted to be back.
No, of course not.
And Brian Burke needed a goalie. Who knows James Reimer better than Brian Burke?
Yeah.
I don't know if Dave Notis had a big price tag on him, but I think that was pretty telling. Winnipeg didn't. They needed a goalie.
Not according to them. They love Andre Pavelec for whatever reason.
They needed a goalie. And he still ends up I think that's how he's viewed around the league. I think that's the book on him. It might not be fair, but that seems to be the book on him.
Well, it's kind of interesting. And of course, Twitter blew up when Dave Nonis showed up yesterday at the Canucks-Oilers game. And maybe the Oilers need another former Leafs goalie. They already have one. Why not throw another into the mix there? Is that a possibility that the Oilers could make a move for James Reimer? And I wonder what the return would be. I mean, if Dave Nonis is out there scouting that game, is it fair to put two and equal four?
Probably not, but we can wildly speculate anyways. I mean, from the, you know, it'd be perfect because they get Scrivens back, right? They trade Reimer where he can go battle for number one spot, not be a situation where a team is saying we're handing you the keys to the crease. And then the Leafs, at least from the vantage point of stability and, you know, shutting off this constant talk about their goaltending, now they have a clear one too. Like, if you truly believed, if you're Dave Nonis and you don't have one speck of doubt that Bernier is your guy, to some degree, wouldn't you say, well, even if Ben Scrivens isn't as good a goalie as James Reimer, if I believe he's a capable backup who can play 20 games, to get rid of this nightmare and not have to, you know, constantly have our room ask questions about this, okay, forget it. You know, give us the guy who's clearly number two. We'll give you a guy who's 1A because you, who knows, maybe he has an on year and helps you solve your problems. But yes, I think we're probably making wild leaps just based on the fact that Nonis was at a hockey game as he's a general manager of a hockey team and he needs to watch hockey games.
I guess that makes sense. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Jeff Simmons and Ryan Dixon. I am Ben Ennis. One last thing on Jonathan Bernier and handing him the car keys. And yes, I know he was probably the reason why the Maple Leafs were defying all the advanced statistics the first half of last season. And I mentioned that California road trip that went well and then he got injured and the Leafs were never the same. Even when he was playing well, there are games where he allows the odd crappy goal. And you can point to those first two games against both the Penguins and the Montreal Canadiens. Well, the Canadiens game, they lost by one, and that first goal of the game was horrible.
Like he does that on occasion. So if you want to nitpick about Jonathan Bernier, I think it's not quite a constant with him, but you're not surprised when he allows that soft-ish goal, in my opinion. He tends to do it.
Yeah, that came up a bit last year, and that would be the one knock on him. But I think over the bigger sample size, you'll see his play.
It's like the shortstop in baseball, right? Like, he'll make the occasional error, but he'll make the spectacular play, and you almost want that more than the steady guy, like Derek Jeter, who makes every play, but he's not going to get to that ball to his left. Also, the big news, Jake Gardner finally drawing into a game after a couple of days in the press box. That, I don't know if that is the bigger news or that Stefan Robidoux was the guy that was lifted to get him in there. And I think by rights, it was probably the right move. But I was surprised that Randy Carlyle had the cojones after Dave Nonis went and picked up Stefan Robidoux. He was their biggest offseason acquisition in an offseason that was, granted, not all that exciting. But he's making $3 million. He's locked up until 2017. He's an older dude, had a couple broken legs. He only played one preseason game. Hasn't looked great this season. So it kind of makes sense that he was the guy lifted from the lineup to put Jake Gardner in there. But we're all talking. I know one of the preseason storylines was, well, Randy Carlyle doesn't really have a say. I mean, they hired a bunch of assistant coaches that he had no say in. And Dave Nonis is kind of undermined as well by Kyle Dubas and the guys that have been brought in by Brendan Shanahan around him. This is almost kind of a Randy Carlyle asserting his dominance, in my opinion, to lift Robidoux and put Jake Gardner in there.
I think they at least have the cover of back-to-back, right? Like, if this was just a Wednesday night where they didn't play for 2 days before and didn't play for a day after or something, it would really catch your attention, whereas you can dress this up pretty easily as old guy coming off two broken legs, back-to-back, you know, still the dust is still settling on the back end. But yeah, you're right. Anytime the, as you said, key offseason acquisition is a scratch when the season's a week old, it doesn't necessarily bode well. And obviously, given what a talking point for bad reasons the Leafs defense corps has been in recent times, you know, just the anything that indicates more instability, anything that indicates that it's moving, it's not getting any closer to being a settled group that can calm things down a bit. You know, people are going to run with that, and it's natural too.
And Stuart Percy has been the guy that's kind of benefited the most from playing time this season. Although last night you could say was his worst game of the season. Led the team with three giveaways, playing almost 20 minutes a game. Yesterday played 1940, tail end of back-to-backs. We could see maybe Stuart Percy sit for the first time this season, which would make sense, and Robidoux back in the lineup. Is that a good scenario for this team to have kind of the rotating door of defensemen where it's a different guy every night, and sometimes it'll be a young guy like a Stuart Percy or Jake Gardner, and sometimes it'll be an older vet like a Stefan Robidoux, Jeff?
No, I don't think that's a healthy situation at all. And I think considering how the defense has played, at least last year and to start this year, I think continuity is very important. And I think a revolving door in that kind of situation is going to have players on their heels. And it's going to be hard to be comfortable because if you know if we have one bad game, you might get sat out the next night. I don't think that's a healthy way to run a hockey team. And I don't think you should bench necessarily Percy because he's had one of four bad games. I don't think that's the way to go, and I think that sends a poor message.
Well, there's two ways to look at it, right? Like there's you think the guys are kind of motivated by competition. That's, you know, we tend to think that that's what's happening with the goaltending situation, that both guys are going to feed off this great competition. They know they screw up one game, could be sitting, and if the other guy gets hot, could be a long time on the bench. Is it not fair to say that that could possibly take place on the blue line as well, that maybe competition does breed a little success back there, Ryan?
Maybe a little bit, but I guess the obvious difference is as a goalie, it's just you, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with a defenseman, you're trying to develop some chemistry with a partner. So if you're kind of out, then you're in, but now you're in with this guy, and then Friday night you're playing on your offside and Sunday night you're playing on your right side. I agree with Jeff that I don't really see it as a healthy situation there. And I mean, I guess the tricky part with the Leafs is three of those guys, Gardner, Morgan Rielly, and Stuart Percy, are all still really young or quite young anyways. So, I mean, with young players, you always want, you know, the last thing you want is for them to be spending extended stretches of time watching hockey instead of playing hockey. So, I mean, on merit, I think we've all agreed that Percy deserves to be in there. But it's, you know, it's hard to know who, if he's in there full time, who's getting squeezed out full time. I think that's an interesting question.
Well, and you'd think, well, an injury will solve all this and there'll be nothing to worry about because someone's going to get injured. But the Maple Leafs were surprisingly very healthy on the blue line last year. They didn't have to call anybody up.
Robidoux doesn't have any more legs left to break. So
that's right. Yeah, he doesn't have a third leg to break. And there's a joke there, I'm sure. But is part of the problem maybe with Gardner and Randy Carlyle's, you know, on-off relationship with him, and we know the drama that surrounded these two in the offseason, probably makes it easier for Jake when he's locked up till 2019 now, and it's you can easily shrug off a couple of nights in the press box when you're making, you know, $3 million, $4 million bucks a season, like Jake Gardner is. $4 million bucks. But is part of the problem potentially that they keep playing Morgan Riley and Jake Gardner together? Because guys with pretty similar skill sets, guys who like to carry the puck, who are that offense, not maybe offense first, but offense is a big part of their games, and puck carrying and getting into the offensive game is both part of their skill sets. Would it not be wise to maybe put them with more defensive-minded defensemen and just break them up? Because I know they're good buddies, and it makes sense maybe from a chemistry standpoint to have them play together, but seems like maybe it's time to look at something else.
The problem is the Leafs don't have Rod Langway back there to, you know, like there's not exactly a standout option as old Steady Eddie that you can put the kid with. So, I mean, they're clearly kind of making it up as they go along. And, you know, the only constant for a lot of years, for better or worse, was obviously Gunnarsson and Phaneuf, and Gunnarsson's now gone. So, yeah, I mean, they're shaking it up. And it's hard to see exactly. I mean, if you said a month from now, what do you think it'll look like? It's hard to predict exactly how it's going to settle in with, you know, who will be the six and who they'll be playing with.
So the Maple Leafs play game two of their back-to-backs against the Red Wings tonight. And if we're going to talk about the Red Wings, before we get to the head coaching situation, just a second, got to give a shout-out to Gustav Nyquist, who a lot of people thought maybe it was a bit of an outlier what he did last season, but so far so good. The guy just continues to score, Ryan. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the interesting thing with Nyquist is when you look at the Red Wings, and obviously they're kind of in a rebuild, and they're still given a lot of credit for, you know, developing guys and bringing them along slowly, and no question that you know, that's been their model, and they've been able to start to fill some holes. But my question for Detroit in terms of whether it's going to be able to get back to elite status has always been, well, who are going to be their stars? Who's going to be the Datsyuk and Zetterberg when they inevitably leave? And I think for the most part, you know, even the Red Wings would be the first to tell you that they got lucky with Datsyuk and Zetterberg. Those guys were drafted, so, you know, as the scouts would say, if we knew they were that good, we wouldn't have drafted them in the third or fifth round or whatever.
Yeah.
So I've always kind of thought to myself, you know what, it's all nice and well that the Red Wings can develop some good, solid B-plus players, but who's going to be the lead horses? So now you're looking at Nyquist and going, man, maybe this guy could be the next guy to be, you know, not just a good player, but a really good player, because, you know, Detroit doesn't look like it's going to be in the Connor McDavid sweepstakes anytime soon. They're no longer a prime. Even if there were free agents available in the summer, Detroit's kind of stopped becoming a destination for them. So the question is, like, where were they going to get their A players? So they need some of their guys to go even beyond what they had hoped, the way Datsyuk and Zetterberg did. Maybe Nyquist is doing that right now.
Yeah, another guy of that Zetterberg mold, too. A Swedish guy drafted in the fourth round, 121st overall by the Red Wings. They continue to do it. It makes no sense, but there it is. He scored 28 goals in just 57 games last season, and now he's got four in four games for the Red Wings. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Jeff Simmons of Sportsnet Magazine. Now, Nick Kyprios had a story this week on Sportsnet and Sportsnet.ca about the Maple Leafs in conversations before the season, before they gave that extension to Randy Carlyle, about Mike Babcock, and I guess you could work out some sort of trade like they do occasionally in baseball for a head coach, because this is the final year of his contract with the Red Wings. He's going to be the most sought-after free agent head coach maybe in NHL history, and there's been rumors for a long time about the Maple Leafs being interested, and now it's starting to trickle out. We know he doesn't want to talk about it. Actually told the media he wasn't going to talk about it before yesterday's game. But that makes a whole lot of sense that the Maple Leafs would have conversations about this guy, Jeff.
Yeah, this is kind of the story that won't go away. And it's not going to, considering he's almost in that lame duck status now. And it all kind of adds up, because there's a belief around the league that if a coach that they won was available, the guy in San Jose didn't get fired like many thought they would, that Randy Carlyle wouldn't have been back this year. And Mike Babcock makes sense on a number of levels. There's rumors that he is kind of looking for a new challenge. The Detroit thing's starting to get a little stale.
He wants a challenge. There's plenty of challenges here.
This is the challenge. So you can get the money here. You can get the reputation. If you can fix this team, then you can almost do anything. So almost everything adds up. It just comes down to Babcock, and everything points to this happening, but you just don't know. But it all makes sense. He hasn't signed, which kind of rings a red flag to me. Like, I'm wondering what's going on there. Doug McLean brought it up on the radio a couple weeks ago. He was stunned that they haven't come to a new deal. So nothing would surprise me at this point.
Is he coming to Toronto no matter what, Ryan? Is it just, are we delaying it a year? I mean, Randy Carlyle, yeah, he signed the extension because he can't be a lame duck head coach. But is there anything he can, well, I guess if they make the playoffs and go like into the second round, Randy Carlyle, would be tough to fire him after that. But if they're, you know, yeah, outside 10th, 9th, even 8th, is it possible that the Maple Leafs make the move for Mike Babcock?
I think part one of that equation feels like an inevitability, that Randy Carlyle probably isn't, this isn't a job for life for him, you know? Yeah. Like, I think he's probably, you know, on a little bit of borrowed time, unless, as you said, the Leafs, you know, go to the second round of the playoffs or something. The Babcock stuff, I certainly wouldn't be comfortable going to. It's an inevitability that he's coming to Toronto. Yeah, I guess it could be, you know, it's probably actually a situation a little bit akin to when Brian Burke came here, because when Burke came here from the Ducks, you know, he was absolute universally viewed as one of the best GMs in the league. This was the prestige opportunity to come here and turn around the Leafs. And
how'd that work out?
And here we are 7 years, 8 years, or 6 years later, maybe. Anyways, we all know sort of how that worked out. I mean, I think in some ways, Babcock is the perfect candidate, because you don't want to come take a job like this if you haven't already won the cup, because that's the number one goal for every coach, GM, whatever, is you want to get that ring. So Babcock's got that
ring.
He's
done it all. He's got the Olympic gold.
Yeah, exactly.
He's done everything.
So now you could be, if depending on how your brain works, you could be thinking about legacy. And there's perhaps even in all of North American sports, there might not be a better legacy building opportunity than being the person who guided the sad sack Toronto Maple Leafs to a Stanley Cup. So, to some degree, the Leafs can trade on that. You know what I mean? Like, they can say, come here, and in addition to us paying you heaps of money, have a chance to, you know, as Brian Burke said, to use that example again, have schools named after you. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to, as much as we can sit here from the outside and say, well, he's probably getting bored in Detroit or what have you, like, the Red Wings are turning things over. I'm sure Mike Babcock values the relationship he has with Ken Holland. You know, it's hard to know exactly how much value someone places on their current work situation in terms of it being stable and comfortable. So we'll see.
I wonder why this hasn't happened yet. If it is an inevitability.
That's what I would think too,
If Mike Babcock wants to be here and expects to be here when he's this free agent coach at the end of the season, and the Maple Leafs were having conversations with the Detroit Red Wings, unless it was some sort of compensation where the Red Wings weren't getting enough and they said, you know what, screw you, we're going to keep Mike Babcock for another year and make another go of it this year, and then whatever, you can pay him your $5-6 million in the offseason to be your head coach. I wonder why this move isn't made. And if Mike Babcock's heart is already in Toronto, not unlike John Farrell here with the Blue Jays, if you're the Red Wings, why do you let him stick around? But he hasn't signed an extension. It's just a head-scratching situation. I expect him to be here, but I just don't know why he's not yet. It just doesn't make any sense to me, Jeff.
Yeah, that's the tough thing about the whole situation. You don't want to speculate and you don't want to assume that he's going to come here or assume he's going to leave, but it's just so strange that he hasn't signed an extension. And Ryan mentioned, he's every time he talks about it, he brings up that relationship with Ken Holland. How do you think he's going to like working with the board here?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that kind of drove Tim Lewicki a bit crazy. I think that was one of the parts that led to him exiting. And I don't think Mike Babcock's the kind of guy that likes dealing with suits all the time. And that's going to be a big part of Toronto. And sometimes you have to step back and wonder, maybe it won't be Toronto. Maybe it might be somewhere else.
But we can all agree that Mike Babcock is one of the superior head coaching candidates around the league, right? Like if you're going out there and picking up, if you want to pick up the best head coach on paper in the NHL and you're the Maple Leafs, and yes, the salary cap exists for players, but not for executives and head coaches, Mike Babcock is your guy, right, Ryan?
Yeah, absolutely. And if the Penguins, if their vacancy had come up one summer later than it did, they would probably be leading the speculation train because of the relationship Babcock has with Sidney Crosby from the Olympics. And, you know, everyone, I think, you know, it was pretty clear that Crosby liked playing for him, even if it was in a 2-week period. So when you look at that team that has underachieved in terms of not winning another Stanley Cup, you know, there would have been, I think, screams that he would be going there. So, yeah, I mean, you know, they're obviously... Analytics are, you know, quite vogue right now, and people everywhere around the league are talking about possessing the puck. Before we had names like Corsi and Fenwick, the Detroit Red Wings were talking about having the puck. And yeah, that's obviously goes way beyond Mike Babcock. That's about the guys who are getting the players into the organization. But that's what Mike Babcock was coaching in 2006, 2007, 2008, when the Red Wings were, you know, a really, really, really good team. And you looked around the league and there were still way more people who were saying, you know, you got to play, you dump it in and crack people. And Detroit was saying, give us the skinny kid from Finland. We'll make him, you know, he's quick and he's smart. We can work with this. So if the Leafs want to continue to move in that direction, you know, certainly Babcock would be a candidate. But as you said, you know, league-wide, I think the fact that he's been involved with that type of play for a long time would make him a very desirable candidate.
And Maple Leafs get another good look at him tonight as they head to Detroit to play the Red Wings for the second straight day. You can see it on CBC, Hockey Night in Canada. Also hear it, of course, on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Hockey begins, well, with Hockey Nation at 5 o'clock and then the broadcast pregame show at 6:30 on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. When we come back, have a look around the league and some other stories going on, including the Hurricanes, who just, you know, everybody gets injured. All their best players done, except for Eric Staal, who could be on the trade block. Also, the Oilers, oh, they lose again. Only gave up 2 goals, though. Progress? We'll talk about the future of Dallas Eakins in Alberta as well. Plenty more coming your way. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Jeff Simmons and Ryan Dixon. I'm Ben Ennis on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Dave Zirum.
He wants to make this harder for himself, harder than it has to be. That's the goal, for practice to be as close to hell as he'll ever get. That's how, year after year, DeMar DeRozan gets better. Hard work. It's not complicated. The Raptors star has plenty to show for it, too. Last year, he became an All-Star for the first time. He also made his first playoff appearance, leading the Raptors to home court advantage. This summer, he added a gold medal as member of Team USA at the World Cup. But ask DeRozan, and he won't hesitate to tell you, he's not satisfied yet. Far from it. From his struggles preparing for the draft 5 years ago to late nights alone on the Raptors practice court in Toronto, I'll take you behind the scenes with one of the fastest rising stars in the game as he looks to take the next step in his career and take the rest of the Raptors franchise with him. It's why DeMar DeRozan just might be the hardest working man in the NBA.
In the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on newsstands now, and for your tablet and mobile phone on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis, along with Jeff Simmons and Ryan Dixon of Sportsnet Magazine. Carolina Hurricanes, oh, man. They did something to piss off the hockey gods because Jeff Skinner's out for the season. Jordan Staal. Eric Staal's alive. But how long will he be in a Hurricanes uniform? As the Canes off to an 0-2-2 start, 2 points through their first four games. And now rumors swirling all over the place that Eric Staal could be the latest big name to be on the move out of Carolina. He has no movement clause as part of his contract and just locked up for two more years. So not a huge commitment for somebody to pick up. His deal done after the 2016 season of a cap hit of $8.25 million. Maple Leafs among those that have been rumored to be in the mix for Eric Staal, but they're in the mix for everybody, apparently. It's going to take, you would think, some combination of young players and draft picks to pry Eric Staal away from Carolina, and he's going to have to want to go somewhere and give up the ghost of playing with his brother Jordan, which didn't really work out all that well in Carolina. Does this make sense at all for the Leafs, Ryan?
I don't think so. I mean, from the perspective of filling a need, yes. But of course, part two of that equation is what do you have to give up? And I just don't think the Leafs are at a point in their trajectory, their arc, whatever exactly that arc is, where they're in a position to say, well, we'll give up a cluster of young guys to try and get someone who can fill a big need at center, because they're not a team that's looking to get to the next level. They're still trying to establish themselves and take inventory of what they have with their young players to figure out, like, you know, have we got the makings of a competitive team here that can consistently make the playoffs? I just think there's, you know, they're in that sort of group where it's still, you know, sorted out life and death to make the playoffs. They're not yet in that group of teams where you're saying, well, we're a pretty good team. We should make the playoffs. We got to find a way to get to the next level. Oh, here's a 6'3" number one center. That should help. You know, I just don't think the Leafs, based on what they would presumably have to get up, I think he'd be robbing Peter to pay Paul a bit.
Yeah, this is the mistake. This would be the classic Leafs mistake. This they'd be paying for a guy that his best years might be behind him. He's almost 30 already, and they've done this before, and it's the same old story. And I think they need to start getting away from these moves. And as Ryan said at the end there, to trade for Staal, you're going to have to create another hole in your roster. So you're going to have to give up a center. You're going to have to give up some young players. I don't think that kind of move makes sense for the Leafs. And I think this is the kind of move that has hurt them in the past. And they've given up players to get guys in their 30s. And it's just, it's a mistake. You have to learn from your mistakes. And this is the same old story for the Leafs.
That being said, he's not ancient, right? He's not 37. He's going to turn 30 at the end of this month. And probably still some positive years ahead of him. It's not an entirely Leafs-ish move. I guess the Leafs-ish move would be if he's like 37 and they're kind of like a middling playoff team and you give up a nice young player or a draft pick that turns into somebody great for a guy of that ilk. If you can sign him to an extension that takes him beyond next season as well, it could be a nice pickup for somebody. Probably not the Maple Leafs. If it's not the Leafs, Ryan, who makes sense to be the suitor for Eric Staal?
It's tough because if you'd asked that question before the summer, you know, before he'd even finished asking the questions, we would have said Anaheim. But they went out and filled that number two hole by getting Kessler. We also saw, obviously, the St. Louis Blues added Stastny. And so you're looking at teams over there who are trying to get over the hump, trying to win Stanley Cups, and where it's just a death match in the West. You know, Dallas, another team that went out and added Spezza. So there's a whole bunch of teams in the West who just added a really big piece at center. And, you know, obviously Chicago's been without a number two guy, a real number two guy, basically throughout their whole rise. But they just don't have room to add a guy who makes north of $8 million on the salary cap. So, I mean, when you look around, just purely, you know, connecting the dots, one team that, like its ancient original six blood rival, Toronto, one team that's always been looking for a big center is Montreal. You know, they obviously wanted Matt Sundin once upon a time when he was coming to the end of his run with the Leafs. You know, they believe that they have a number one guy in waiting in Alex Galchenyuk, but they haven't been able to find a way to get him in the middle. That he's kind of been stuck on the wing because just sort of the way the lineup sets up, they've got David Desharnais who pairs well with Max Pacioretty. They've got Thomas Buchanan who's kind of been rejuvenated in more of an offensive role at center. And they've got Lars Eller who's a bit of a wrecking ball number three guy. So they haven't been able to get Galchenyuk in there. You know, the Canadians have done a pretty good job drafting over the years. They've got a few, you know, intriguing prospects. I mean, if they could ever find a way to clear a little room, if they could, you know, take a group of prospects and maybe package Desharnais to create a hole in the middle, then yeah, maybe that's, you know, who knows? I'm just looking at teams and spitballing and saying, here's a team that went to the East Final last year. Here's a team that probably should make the playoffs this year, has a, you know, long chronicled history of being a little undersized up front, especially at the middle. As you said, you know, you're not going out. It's not like the Canadians will have to win the Stanley Cup this year. You know, Eric Staal's got a couple years left. Maybe he sticks around. So, you know, maybe that they're a candidate. And you know, I one you guys might want to pick up on as well is the Rangers because, you know, they're,
Everybody goes to
another
the
team that's in on them, right?
Yeah.
And he's got the brother there.
Yeah. For 1 year anyway until he's UFA.
That's working out well in Carolina.
Yeah.
Yeah, the brother thing didn't exactly work out. Not exactly working out in Edmonton either so far. We're still waiting for all these first round high picks to put it together. And not that they've been bad, just this Oilers team can't keep the puck out of its own net. And I guess part of it's goaltending, part of it might be defensive scheme, and part of it is just the defensemen on that team. They lose again yesterday, 2-0 at home to the Canucks. They only allowed 2 goals, which I guess is something. Ben Scrivens takes the loss, making 28 saves. The Oilers now 0-4-1, and like we knew it would, if they got off to a slow start again this year, the countdown on Dallas Eakins has begun, and people are wondering when that bullet is fired by the Edmonton Oilers, because I don't think anybody expected them to be a playoff team in the West this year, because we just mentioned how tough it is in the Western Conference. But show something, show some sort of improvement. And although I know it's funny to say, if you win the lottery again and get Connor McDavid, isn't this another draft that you'd love to be near the top of? Should you be that disappointed if you are an Oilers fan and this team could be headed to the lottery once again?
Well, that would be an outstanding scenario for them. But they still need another center. But I think you can't be excited about what's going on in Edmonton right now. They got the worst goal differential in the league. They got all these number one picks, and they're just not improving. Dallas Eakins, when he was in Toronto, he had this mystique of the next great head coach, and since he's gone there, they haven't improved at all. In fact, they've gone worse. There's so many problems there. They can't play defense at all. They don't have a number two center, and in that conference, that's really tough. And their goaltending hasn't been good at all this year, so they really need to start showing something, or else I don't think Eakins is going to last, because that was supposed to be the defensive scheme and toughness. That was supposed to be his thing, and it's not translating at all.
You wonder, too, to what degree the vultures are circling around the league, just kind of rubbing their hands, being like, okay, when is this going to get to a point where Craig McTavish has to trade one of these guys, and how low can I buy one of these guys? You know, can I go get Nail Yakupov, a number one pick from 2012, for a song? You know, and obviously McTavish is, you know, these guys hold their positions for a reason, and he's not going to give guys away. But at the same time, things go so grotesquely bad that it gets to a point where something has to be done. And obviously there's been, you know, chatter for a while that one of these offensive-minded young players is going to have to be sacrificed for the greater good. And, yeah, I wonder, you know, who around the league is just kind of, all right, when's the perfect time to call Mac T and see who he might want to part with, because something has to change.
And as bad as things are for the Oilers right now, that is the nightmare scenario for the Oilers, is that they trade one of those guys for not enough. And you go through all this losing and all these high draft picks, and you're left with not very much. Not unlike the goaltending situation in Vancouver, where they didn't end up with much after having two top-tier goaltenders. But going to be interesting times in Edmonton going forward, no question. That team that beat them yesterday is kind of an interesting one as well, Vancouver. And maybe kind of a dark horse team to make the playoffs in the West. Mentioned how tough it's going to be to get in, but there were a lot of injuries that played into their missing of the playoffs last year. I think head coaching was definitely a problem. And they are drama-free for the first time in a long time, Ryan.
Yeah, absolutely. If Vancouver didn't make one player personnel move in the summer and just change the coach and general manager, it was going to be a better vibe there regardless. And, you know, I'll happily count myself as someone who looked at them at the end of last year and thought, well, you know, what course of action is there to take other than to sort of tear it down and join the rest of the Western Canadian NHL teams and rebuild? And to some degree, I do wonder where they're going long term, because when they went out and got Ryan Miller, you know, I kind of thought to myself, well, that, you know, he's a good goalie, but he seemed to be more a fit with a team that was for sure going to the playoffs, or a better team than Vancouver certainly was last year. But you know what? Number one, we all know that it's not a panacea to just say, you know, let's throw in the towel. I mean, that is the epitome of something that's easy to say from the outside. So lo and behold, you know, Jim Benning, the new GM, every little move he made, Verbata from Phoenix, getting Miller, they all solidified the team. You know, I think they looked at the Sedins and said, well, they're not going to be 45-point guys again.
Yeah.
You know, they looked at Alex Edler and said, he's not going to be minus 147 again. We got some decent players here. And they're all going to get a breath of fresh air. Let's see what we can do. And I got to say too, I mean, they made a couple of sneaky, good little moves too, with, picking up Lyndon Vay from LA, where they, you know, a kid can't crack the lineup. And some people are really high on Nick Bonino. I think when the Ryan Kessler trade happened, we all kind of thought, well, we thought we'd recognize more names, or at least, you know, there'd be better players going back. I think Bonino is the classic. Well, he played for Anaheim, a team that we don't really see a lot, but some people think long-term he might be a real nice one. So you throw in Bo Horvat from the Corey Schneider trade in a couple years, and you know, while it's, you're not going, you know, presto changeo Stanley Cup contender, I think you can say, hey, yeah, Vancouver could avoid a long, drawn out, ugly rebuild. The problem is they're just never going to draft a guy number one or two overall, probably.
Yeah, and the Red Wings have gotten by without doing that pretty well. When we come back, World Series about to crank up on Tuesday, game one, Kansas City Royals and San Francisco Giants. Could have won a whole bunch of money betting on that before the season started. We will preview the World Series, also look back at how these two teams got there. Also, we'll have a look at the NFL and a big deal for wide receiver Percy Harvin on the move to the New York Football Jets. All that and more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Magazine Live. I am Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dickinson and Jeff Simmons of Sportsnet Magazine. World Series gets underway on Tuesday in Kansas City, because remember, the American League won the All-Star game. I'm sure you don't remember. I don't really remember it either, except for Adam Wainwright feeding Derek Jeter a cookie. I remember that part. Apparently, the American League won that game, so the Kansas City Royals have home field advantage, and they're in the World Series. They haven't lost a game this postseason. 8 straight wins. First time in the postseason since 85. First time back in the World Series since 85, when they beat the Cardinals in 7 games in a pretty interesting series almost 30 years ago. This one should be interesting as well, because they're playing the San Francisco Giants, and it's two teams who were wild card teams, had to win a 1-game playoff just to continue their postseason, and the Royals were down 4 runs in that 1-game playoff against the Oakland A's that came back to win it, and maybe the best game of the postseason so far. But there's been plenty of other great games this postseason. It's been one of the best I can remember, with maybe one or two maybe three games that have been kind of out of reach from the get-go. Everything seems to be close and late, even though the series aren't going seven games. Every game has been spectacular. But what does it mean, if anything, that there are two wildcard teams in the World Series, two teams who did not win their division, and two teams we didn't predict to be anywhere near here? Does it diminish the fact that you played 162 games and it's the Royals and Giants in the World Series, Jeff?
I think it has to. I think the division winners almost lose something for their production during the regular season. And the playoffs is just such a small sample size. And it's almost unfair to the teams that won a division, but that's part of the game. And that's, they're more interested, obviously, in giving more of a chance for teams to make the playoffs for the TV numbers, but it almost does diminish the regular season. And when you see two wild cards in the World Series, that sums it up right there.
Baseball is the only game where you play every day. You play 162 games. It's by far the most out of any of the major professional leagues in North America. And Ryan, this is a sports culture in North America where we're not like Europe. We're not like English soccer where you can just, you know, be the champion of a regular season. They don't even have a playoff system, right? Obviously, in the Premier League, there are teams going into the season who realize they have no chance of winning, and they take pride in finishing eighth or ninth in the Premier League, in a 20-team Premier League. If you told, you know, the Tigers, you should just be happy that you won the division. You were the best team in the American League Central through 162 games. That was an accomplishment. Nobody's going to buy that, are they?
No. I mean, we don't really have ties either in North America. I mean,
right.
We're clearly a last man or woman standing culture. And you're right. It's funny because even just in my own sort of evolution as a sports watcher fan, you know, I would have always thought, well, it's so weird that there's not playoffs in soccer. Like, that's so weird. You know, how do you, it's just the season's over. That's, you know, but when you put it in the context of baseball, and I feel like it's been getting more and more attention, maybe especially because of the Billy Bean, you know, I can make a team succeed in the first part in the regular season, but for the life, you know, it seems like to some degree you're either asking teams to do two different things or that it is just completely random and, you know, Team X gets hot for a while. So, yeah, I mean, it's just not part of our sporting culture here to really reward the regular season. You know, I think most of us have the mentality of regular season's over. Okay, time to really pay attention because now it really counts.
Well, the comparison that can be made is the San Jose Sharks, right? And someone tweeted this out. Was it Nick Conseca? Who was it? Someone tweeted out that the Sharks could go 82-0 and it doesn't matter because their success, good or bad, is going to be determined when it comes to playoff time. Is there something sad about that? That we're putting such little emphasis on the regular season where you play by far the majority of your games?
I think less so in hockey because it is a different season unto itself and it's 2 months and it's all a seven-game series. In baseball, I think I could be convinced that it kind of isn't fair. And it's just so weird how a sport would just completely reverse its entire sort of ethic, you know, like for 6 months of the year or whatever, baseball is all about, you know, the game, there's no clock on the game. It's all about, you know, things happening on its own time. And we have this long drawn out season. It's a test of endurance. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, Tuesday night in Pittsburgh, one of these teams is in, one of these teams is out. And it doesn't seem to match with the, you know, baseball's ethos, but at the same time, you know, the format as it stands does keep more teams in the playoff race. I mean, is it worth it just to say, you know what, three more cities that would have thrown in the towel in August get fun baseball for another month?
And
you know?
And there's no question that the games have been fun.
Exciting,
playoffs,
yeah, no doubt.
The playoffs have been fun, if not fair. But should we be striving for fun or fair, I guess, is the question, Jeff.
Yeah, life's never fair.
I guess.
Yeah, well, you can poke holes in every sport and find issues where they're never fair. I think the games have been outstanding, and that's been the thing that stood out about the playoffs, and I think the league couldn't be happier with that, and I think it's been good for everyone, and the Royals and the Giants both their series have been insanely good, and I think fun almost beats fair in this scenario.
Yeah, I don't think the league's thinking about ways to change things, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's true, even though it might not be fair, but Is there a way to build a team specifically for the playoffs? Because if there is, I'm sure teams are trying to figure that out, and Billy Beane's trying to figure it out. I apparently isn't picking up every great starter in all of baseball. Maybe if you want to draw conclusions about the two teams left standing, it's about having a great bullpen. And the Kansas City Royals specifically, it's game over if they're leading after six, right? Those three guys, Herrera, Davis, and Holland at the back end of that bullpen are almost untouchable. So maybe that is the new formula for success. Of course, we're just talking about 1 year with the Kansas City Royals, right? So who knows? Maybe that's the way you can win in the playoffs going forward. And we see more teams build their teams around that.
I don't know if you can specifically build a team to win in the playoffs, but I think speed, defense, and pitching, especially from the bullpen, have been tenets of winning baseball for so long. And those are just consistent themes of teams that can win. And the playoffs are such a small sample. Any team could really get hot at some point. It happens throughout the year.
But how come it never happens to the Oakland A's, you know, right? How come, for whatever reason, in their Billy Beane era, they have great regular seasons, and for whatever reason, it just never happens in the playoffs? Is there something to be said for playoff experience? I mean, I guess you could make that case about the San Francisco Giants, but not about the Royals, right? So it's almost, so is it, am I trying to draw conclusions from just a scenario where you can't possibly, because it is not quite like drawing ping pong balls out of a bin, but pretty damn close.
Yeah, it seems to be. And I guess the last team that would have been truly dominant regular season, postseason, would have been the Yankees of the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, it's still sports, and if you've got by far the best team, I think your chances are still better. But yeah, I mean, you look at, I mean, I would have thought, if there was something that would give you a huge advantage in the playoffs, it's having that one or two absolute stud starting pitchers. Mm-hmm. And you look at Detroit and Oakland, and it just didn't work out.
And Clayton Kershaw had He had one of the more historically great regular seasons in recent memory. Missed a little bit of time at the early parts of the season because of an injury he suffered when he went over to Australia to play with that Dodgers team. But he was unbelievably great, and what happened to him in the playoffs was one of the greater dramas I can remember. Giving up home runs in the seventh inning to left-handers who don't hit lefties, that was unbelievable. Is it fair to put the choke label on guys when it comes to playoff time? And I guess you can shed that label. Alex Rodriguez had that label for a while until they did win a World Series with the New York Yankees. I think it's fair to say that Clayton Kershaw at this moment has that label as a choke type guy when it comes to playoff time. The Washington Nationals had one of the best teams in all of Major League Baseball. They've kind of done that two out of the last 3 years where they've been in the playoffs. Oakland A's. I wonder if there are just some guys who, when it comes to playoff time, don't perform for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've moved sort of away from that mentality. I mean, with baseball leading the charge, but I mean, I think anyone out there would acknowledge that different situations make different people react differently to situations. And I mean, if you just think of it in the context of your own life, if you're coming into work and there's some sort of instability or something in the room has changed, the temperature has changed, and you're feeling a little tight under the collar.
Yeah.
Some people grow an inch and some people retreat a bit. There's, yep. I mean, that it's just, it is human nature. So while I don't think we can circle guys and go choker for life and guy who comes through forever, I mean,
is Peyton Manning still a choker, even though he did win his one Super Bowl? I mean, the numbers are pretty stark. He's an under 500 starter come playoff time. Is it, even though he won that Super Bowl, is it still fair to call Peyton Manning a choke artist when it comes to the playoffs?
I don't know if choke artist is the right word, but I think he definitely doesn't live up to the moment. And he did win his one Super Bowl against Rex Grossman.
So right.
There might be a little bit of an asterisk there. So
a little bit. And the Bears also started that Super Bowl off by returning the opening kickoff for a touchdown as well, which people like to forget. So yeah, the Colts were coming back in that game. Let's get back to the World Series for just a second here. Giants and Royals. Does this series excite you more than maybe a bigger name series? Like, say it was the Dodgers and the Angels, and you had Mike Trout, and you had Clayton Kershaw, and you had Albert Pujols, and all those guys. Would that be a more exciting World Series than two teams that are severe underdogs? And obviously the Royals more than the Giants, who won the World Series just a couple of years ago. What excites you more as a sports fan? Is it the underdog Royals and the Giants who have been there before, or would it be a bigger name matchup like, say, the Dodgers and the Angels, or the Cardinals and the Tigers, or somebody like that, Ryan?
You know, I will confess to a little Royals fatigue. I tend to be the guy who I can get behind the underdog, the team that hasn't been there. And I'm still, just based on, what you've seen in Kansas City. I did a little story on the Royals a couple years ago after they traded Will Myers and, kind of got an appreciation for how much baseball is in the blood there. So absolutely, I'm happy to see this happen in a place where they've been starved for it. But there's no denying the intrigue of the big names. I mean, you mentioned Kershaw. I mean, wouldn't it be cool to see this guy who we always hear compared to Sandy Koufax and, see him on the biggest stage and going shot for shot with, David Price or something. I do think that would be pretty cool. But at the same time, it is, I think a warm and fuzzy Royals Giants World Series is kind of fun. And I don't default to the, well, it's got to be Yankees and Dodgers every time by any stretch. But yeah, it's, I could certainly see the merit in the stars and the storylines that get that inevitably crop up there. But certainly for one fall anyways, to see a team get in there for the first time in 30 years, and that's been historically bad.
Yeah.
When you see how excited they are, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's a great ballpark they play in as well. Also, in the world of baseball, there's been some movement in the front office of both the Tampa Bay Rays and the Los Angeles Dodgers, as Andrew Friedman leaving that team that he's helped create, been a big part of it, their draft picks and smart signings and trades. And he is now the new head of baseball operations in LA with the Dodgers. He said that Don Mattingly will be back next season. He will hire a general manager. But is it finally... And maybe it's easy to say when it's just one guy, but maybe this is the start of something else in Tampa where there's frustration there. It's nice to always kind of be around the playoffs and be able to build a team and do it on a shoestring budget and have a winning atmosphere, although they didn't this year and injuries and whatever. There were a lot of mitigating factors, including trading away their ace in the middle of the season. But Joe Maddon appears to be a pretty good manager. I wonder how long they're able to keep this smart and, by all accounts, one of the smartest front offices in baseball together. Is this the start of people saying, all right, it's one thing to win on a shoestring budget, but it would also be kind of neat if people showed up to see this team that's actually pretty good.
Well, that's the thing that always blows me away about the Rays. I see a city like Toronto that's dying for a winner. And Tampa Bay, the last couple of years, has been such a likable team, the way they've played and the way they've overcome their payroll and gotten the most of what they had. And they can't draw anyone, even when they were winning.
Yeah.
So when Friedman goes to the Dodgers, my first thought is the timing. Why now? So at some point, I wonder, maybe he thinks the magic's running out in Tampa Bay. Maybe they've had to get rid of Price. They've had to get rid of Shields. Their hitting went south this year. Maybe he realizes this thing isn't going to work anymore. And you saw it this year. They weren't a good team at all. So maybe that was my first thought, and I could be off base there, but it seems like they've had a couple bad drafts in a row, and maybe this thing isn't sustainable, and maybe that's why he jumped.
You go from one of the lowest payrolls in all of baseball in Tampa Bay to the highest in Los Angeles, and they just throw money around like it's Monopoly money with the Dodgers. It's ridiculous what they do in L.A. Is that a huge move for them? Are the Dodgers... I mean, they've already built a pretty good team. They were a division winner, and yes, they flamed out in the playoffs. They won 94 games during the regular season. I'm a little surprised that he's already committed to Don Mattingly to be back there as the manager, because if you're going to point to a couple of things, I think Mattingly maybe wasn't the best tactician, especially when it came to playoff time. Are you surprised that he's going to be back for another kick at the can, Jeff?
Yeah, it was very surprising. I was surprised how quickly that they came out and said that they're sticking with Mattingly. Obviously, everyone's first thought was, how do they get Joe Maddon? Because imagine Joe Maddon working with those kind of players, with Puig and Kershaw and Ryu. And this might be just a short stint for Mattingly. Maybe they'll give him a year, evaluate him, see what he's like. I'm sure they're going to bring a new general manager. So I was definitely surprised how quickly they jumped and said they're sticking with him. He's their guy, considering the front office is going to be almost completely new.
It's probably good news for the Blue Jays, naturally, who play in the same division as the Tampa Bay Rays. Who knows, though? There could be another wunderkind who's hanging around in Tampa Bay, who takes over the reins there and gets them back into the playoffs and back near the top of that division as well. When we come back, NFL Sunday, fast approaches, and another great slate of games. Also, big trade possibly to talk about. Not official, but looks like Percy Harvin is on the way from Seattle to New York to play with the Jets. Also, the Dallas Cowboys, they just might be the best team in the National Football League, which I kind of think is fun. Interesting, no question about it, but tough to hate on the Cowboys this time of year, even though it is also fun to hate on the Cowboys and Tony Romo, and he will probably come up with a soul-crushing interception late in the season or the playoffs. NFL talk coming up next. I'm Ben Ennis along with Jeff Simmons and Ryan Dixon. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine. Here's Michael Grange.
I want to say I have the funnest life of anyone in the world. Like, I absolutely love my job. I absolutely love my family, my friends. You know, any chance I have to have fun, I'm going to take that chance.
Drew Doughty is 24. He's pulling down millions. He's twice a Stanley Cup champion and twice an Olympic gold medalist. But the Los Angeles Kings defenseman might have something else almost as important on his resume. He's the king of a good time. Golf, beers, ping pong are chilling in his hot tub with a view of the beach in Los Angeles. Doughty is a refreshing iconoclast. In the age of the robo-athlete, where we get told over and over again that elite athleticism is like devotion, Doughty stands out. Oh, he trains and he takes his job very seriously, but not all the time. And he never forgets that to the victors go the spoils. Is he the best player on the NHL's best team? Maybe. Is he the best defenseman in the league? By the time he's done, he just might be. But along the way, no one is going to have more fun on the ride.
Just myself. I just say what comes to my mind. And you know what? As I've gone to the NHL, I've realized sometimes when I just speak my mind, it gets me in trouble, and it has in the past. But I'm just happy to be where I am today, and happy to be living the life I'm living. And I'm going to live it to the fullest and have fun with it.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on newsstands now, and for your tablet and mobile phone on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Ryan Dixon of Sportsnet Magazine. Can you believe that we're into week 7 of the NFL season already? Yes, we're zoning in on this season being half done. We're almost there. Feels like it just started, but yes, like sand through the hourglass, these are the days of our lives. It's fun to rip the Cowboys, to make fun of Tony Romo and Jerry Jones and his eyes that go sideways, his big head, and his 20-year-old girls on his arm. I mean, that's fun. It's fun to rip them. But you can't right now. You really can't. If you thought they were a fluke to be where they were, it's hard to make that same argument after they knock off the champs. 30-23. They're 5-1. And it really shouldn't have been that close. A couple of special teams errors, and the Cowboys run away with that game. As it stands, very impressive. The ground game is great. Tony Romo's done what been necessary, and the big question of the defense hasn't been a problem because, Jeff, they haven't really been on the field all that much, and I guess that's kind of a good play if you have a weak defense, you think.
Yeah, the strangest part of the Cowboys is they're kind of likable now.
Yeah.
Which kind of goes against everything we all believe in. They're such an easy team to hate, but the way they're, the brand they're playing with their They have such a good offensive line, and they're running the football, and they're not making mistakes. And their defense, which doesn't have any talent at all, it's full of no-names. Mm-hmm. These guys are overachieving like crazy. This defensive coordinator would be the assistant coach of the year right now. They beat Seattle down at home last week in Seattle. No one's done that.
Yeah, that offensive line is good.
They beat them in every level, if not for those special teams things. That's a blowout for the Cowboys. They converted that big 3rd-and-20 last week.
Yep.
They're doing everything right now, and it's strange to watch. And considering that defense was historically bad last year, they lost to Marcus Ware. They lost Jason Hatcher, who was their best defensive lineman. And they're somehow overproducing, and it's been incredible to watch.
Ryan, I mentioned it's fun to hate on the Cowboys, but is the NFL better when the Cowboys are good? Is it kind of like a more fun league when America's team is not the laughingstock of America?
I think so, yeah. I mean, they're a seriously polarizing team. They're, you know, probably the top three iconic franchises in North America. So, yeah, I mean, especially with such a long run where they've been, you know, either bad or just heavily mediocre.
Bunch of 8-8s in a row.
Yeah, just tons. I mean, if anything, it's at least more fun if they're 1-15 and, you know, there's that storyline or what they are now where they're playing well. But, yeah, the Cowboys just aren't meant to be meh. And it's nice to see them break off of that. And, yeah, to the surprise of many, it's broken for the better. So, yeah, how many times is the obituary written on the head coach? And, you know, obviously Jerry Jones as GM was one of the sort of biggest jokes in the league, but here they are.
Yeah, I think maybe part of it is that Jerry Jones really hasn't been involved in the personnel decisions in recent years and the drafting as well. I think if it was up to Jerry Jones, Johnny Football would be on that team right now instead of another offensive lineman. And it's been the offensive line that's gotten it done for the Cowboys, Jeff.
Yeah, you hit it on the head. Jerry Jones has come out multiple times and said that he wanted to take Johnny Football, and he had trouble sleeping after that draft. He thought this was the guy that was going to bring the franchise back to relevancy. But that they took an offensive lineman, Zach Martin from Notre Dame, in the first round. He's been their best offensive lineman.
Yeah.
And imagine if that flips. Imagine if Jerry Jones didn't step back and let the actual personnel guys make the personnel decisions. That team would be completely screwed up right now. Every day would be a Romo, Johnny Football. If you thought you were sick of Johnny Football now, imagine him in Dallas.
Oh, it would have been great, though, too.
Oh.
We really missed out on a great opportunity.
For people who like laughing at the Cowboys, that's the ideal scenario.
But. Yeah. A lot of people are talking about the potential for the Cowboys to be the best team in the NFL. Well, are they? I mean, they beat the best team in the NFL last season, the Super Bowl champs, the Seattle Seahawks last week. So it was hard to argue with the fact that, okay, if you got to beat the champs to be the champs, they are. Are they the best team in the NFL right now, Jeff?
I think so right now. Just the way they're playing is sustainable, and it's a winning brand of football. And when you have an offensive line that good, you can win every week. And DeMarco Murray is he's had one of the best starts to a year in NFL history. And last year you saw it with Seattle, you've seen it with San Francisco.
Will he survive the season, though, carrying the ball 30 times a game?
With that offensive line, maybe.
Really?
Yeah.
You're one of the few guys that's saying that.
Yeah, I think when you have an offensive line that good, it's a lot easier to sustain yourself and you don't get hit as hard. And they have some other running backs if they want to lower his totals throughout the year, but I think he'll be fine.
And in that division, they're still not good enough for first, as the Eagles also 5-1, so tied for first are the Cowboys. They've won 5 straight though after losing that season opener to the San Francisco 49ers, and that was, we thought, the sign of a long season for the Cowboys because they looked horrible in that game, turned the ball over. The Niners completely outplayed them, but how things have changed in the subsequent 5 weeks since then. Mentioned last hour about the Percy Harvin potential deal. Now, it's not official, but it looks like the New York Jets are going to pick up the wide receiver from the Seattle Seahawks for next to nothing, 4th-round pick or something. It's going to be one of those malcontent locker room guys, just for whatever reason, wasn't working in Seattle, and he's going to give it a go with the Jets team that has 1 win this season And I guess they're not playing for a draft pick at this point, even though maybe they should. They dropped to 1-6 after that Thursday night loss to the New England Patriots when they thoroughly outplayed the Pats. But this is kind of a curious move. And Jeff, I know you followed the Seahawks pretty closely. What do you make of the fact that they're cutting ties with one of their better wide receivers?
It's not often I'm blown away or surprised by a trade or a personnel move at this point in the season, but that one just completely caught everyone off guard. And it's been amazing to see the amount of stories that have come out on Twitter, on social media, in Seattle Times, since that rumor broke yesterday. And it sounds like Percy Harvin really screwed up that locker room. And that was the kind of the thing that they had going. They had such good team chemistry, and they really were a good group that really liked playing for each other. But the stories that have come out, one of the surprising ones, apparently him and Golden Tate had an altercation at the Super Bowl. And if you look, you can see a black eye under Golden Tate when he's carrying the Super Bowl trophy. And apparently he had an issue with Doug Baldwin, and apparently there was an issue with Russell Wilson. So after all these locker room issues, and this was the story in Minnesota, this came out when he was there, and which is why they almost traded him in the first place. Why would the Jets want that?
Yeah, I don't know.
And the Jets general manager worked in Seattle. He was the cap guy before he went to New York. And he's pretty tight with Seattle gentlemen. Knowing all this stuff, a team 1-6 with a quarterback that isn't going to please any receiver, why would you want to go out and get this guy who's known for blowing up locker rooms?
Doesn't it make more sense for a team like the Patriots? Isn't this like, it seemed like a Randy Moss type situation. Malcontent in Oakland, they pick him up for nothing. And of course, he sets all those offensive records, Ryan. Wouldn't that make more sense?
Yeah, I mean, from both sides of it, I mean, you know, the Jets, you would think at 1-6, the writing's on the wall. Like,
right.
You think they'd be, you know, going for the draft pick. And yeah, I mean, New England is the, you know, the landing spot for reclamation projects a little bit. And, you know, the one thing or the, you know, the biggest need for them seems to be someone who can stretch the field a little bit. And yeah, it would have, maybe it's a huge indictment of exactly what Harvin's personality is like if Bill Belichick is saying, I don't want him even essentially for nothing, you know?
Well, yeah. Yeah, that could be something. Speaking of the Patriots, they are all of a sudden back in the driver's seat in the AFC East at 5-2. Talked about the big matchup in Buffalo, maybe the biggest matchup and the best chance the Bills had at winning that game in a long time. Well, now they're 2-23 against Tom Brady's New England Patriots after they smoked him and Brady threw for 4 touchdown passes at Ralph Wilson Stadium. Are the Patriots now, you know, one of those teams in the elite tier of the NFL? Or are they just a byproduct of once again playing in a horrible, maybe not horrible, but one of the bottom half of divisions in all of football, Jeff?
I think that's definitely the case. I don't think the Patriots are that Super Bowl contender that they've been for the last decade.
Did beat Cincinnati, though.
That was a game where they were really motivated coming off that horrible loss to Kansas City. I think they're still a playoff team in almost any division, but I don't think they're what they used to be. I've been personally very critical of some of Bill Belichick's moves over the last few years. I don't think they've given Brady enough to work with. And if you look at Denver and see what they've given Peyton Manning as a comparison, I think Brady's kind of gone on the short end there. But I think the division is that there's just no one capable of winning that division. And the Bills just always end up around 500. The Dolphins shoot themselves in the foot, and the Jets are the Jets. So I don't think the Patriots are at the level of even the Chargers, I don't think. But I still think they'll be a playoff team and they'll be in there. But I think that has a lot to do with that AFC East.
Are there any good teams, like great teams in the NFL this year, Ryan?
No, I don't think so. And I was so there's no one undefeated left, right? No one has.
Nope.
So is this the earliest the 72 Dolphins have been able to toast? Because there's no threat at all there. No, there isn't. I mean, you look at Seattle. You know, the Super Bowl hangover, a first loss at home. You know, there's obviously some signs that they're not infallible. And you look at Denver and you think, you just won't believe anything until the playoffs because of the Peyton Manning factor, because right. They've had trouble. So, like, realistically, if Denver doesn't win another game all season, no one's going to be sold on them until they win the Super Bowl. San Francisco's kind of in, you know, they've been a league power, but, you know, aren't quite what they once were. Speaking of teams no one's going to believe in, Cincinnati, which may be, you know, I would think, I mean, you guys can take issue with this, but the top, your AFC power rankings are probably Denver and then San Diego, Cincy in that top three. I mean, Cincinnati, obviously with Dalton, has its issues. And San Diego, too. I mean, they're kind of like both historically disappointing teams. I think the Chargers might be the most fun storyline with Phillip Rivers in this late career resurgence.
They kind of seem like the forgotten team in the NFL, right? Like, people forget that they're 5-1 and Phillip Rivers is playing at almost an MVP level.
Absolutely. No question that they're, I think they're a team that people thought the defense would really struggle, but so far it hasn't really been an issue. But no, to your original question, there's not a team you look at and think, well, it's really going to take something to knock those teams off. Everyone comes with their question marks, which, you know, tends to make for compelling viewing and tends to also make for me really, really struggling in my picks against the spread in our office pool.
Isn't this what makes the NFL great, though? Or would you rather have dynasty teams? We thought that Seattle, because they had so much cap space, because Russell Wilson's not getting paid, that they were able to create a constant winner, a consistent winner. They could still, you know, rattle off a whole bunch of wins, but they've suffered a couple of losses and a near loss to Denver as well. Had to go to overtime, but lost to San Diego, lost to the Cowboys last week. Would you rather have a league like this where anyone can win any week, unless you're the Jacksonville Jaguars or Oakland Raiders? Or is it better when there's dynasties and there's a team that's great over a prolonged period of time? What's better as a sports fan?
I think this is the ideal scenario for a sports fan. I think knowing that any team can win any given week, that's kind of what the NFL lives off of, that any given Sunday thing. And that's certainly been the case this year. I think when there's powerhouses, it's obviously good for the league and it's good in the playoffs. And obviously it's good in the primetime games. But I think situation where there's so many teams in a small gap where the playoff races will be better, the division races will be better. I think that's what every fan wants. Obviously, there's your Raiders and your Jaguars who have no chance. But I think when the league is this close and there's parity, I think that's the ideal scenario for a football fan.
Even the Cleveland Browns, there is hope there. They could be undefeated if they had a couple of breaks go their way. As it stands, they're 3-2, and Brian Hoyer looks okay.
And soft schedule coming up too, right? I think they're, if I'm not mistaken, they're Jacksonville, Tennessee, and Oakland in some order, I think.
Yeah, Jacksonville tomorrow, then they are home against Oakland and Tampa Bay before going to Cincinnati.
That's right. So, yeah, I mean, they could walk into that Cincinnati, you know, if they haven't racked up three more wins going into that Cincinnati game, it would be a huge disappointment. So, yeah, don't sleep on the Browns.
Who would have thought we'd be at this point in the season and really not a whole lot to say about Johnny Football, Johnny Clipboard, which is kind of a shame, I think.
Yeah, speaks to the good record that they have. I guess we did so much talking about him before the season, there's nothing left to cover. So, yeah, it's maybe bad for the news cycle, but great for football in Cleveland that it has essentially dissolved into a non-story at this point.
What's turning into a non-story late in the season, and is surprisingly so, is Toronto FC now on the verge of not being in the playoffs for yet another season. Jermaine Defoe will not play. The last home game of the season goes at 2:00 this afternoon down at BMO Field against the Montreal Impact. Ryan, you're actually going to be at that game. We'll be expecting a detailed report.
I'll call in at halftime.
All right, good. But how much of a joke is that? I mean, Toronto FC is you know, not the forgotten team in this city, but pretty close to it, especially the way things have gone. But they made huge news before the season with their offseason acquisitions of Jermaine Defoe, a real legitimate name and maybe one of the best players ever to play in this league, coming from where he came from and knowing that there were teams in the Premier League that wanted him and wanted him at the transfer window as well. Michael Bradley shows up as well, one of the best American players in recent memory. And here we are, not even down to the last game of the season, two games to go. And yes, they're still mathematically alive. They need to run the table and have Columbus lose both games if they want to make the playoffs. I mean, it's a joke. It's everything had to go as pear-shaped as it did for this team to not be in the playoffs. It's pretty amazing. If you told a Toronto FC fan before the season that they'd be out of the playoff once, they thought, well, the playoffs, or at least we're going to be in the playoffs. They were talking about an MLS title. that this team has gone to where it is right now is pretty hilarious.
Yeah, hopefully that fan wouldn't also be a Leafs and Jays fan, because this would have been too much to take. I mean, it's the crazy storyline of the last 6 months, these meltdowns for Toronto teams to take them out of the playoffs. Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredibly disheartening because of exactly what you said. There was such legit hope before the start of the year. You know, not one but two guys who people are looking at and going, you know, these guys move the needle. Like, this isn't, there's no debate about whether they're past their prime or, you know, these are two guys who you're going to throw into the lineup who should really have a really significant impact. And yeah, to see it just kind of whittled away. I mean, as you said, Ben, too, I mean, as a fan, you're probably thinking, well, at least playoffs, you know, minimum standard.
This was the Tim Lywicki stamp, right? Like, yeah. this was, say what you will, okay, the Raptors took off, and I guess you could say part of his influence had to do with that resurgence from the Raptors' perspective. But that was also, he kind of fluked into that. They were not expected to be near as good as they were last year, and in fact were, you know, expected to tank, and part of the tanking was the trading away of Rudy Gay. So things ended up flipping upside down when they traded away Rudy Gay, and he kind of lucked into what happened with the Raptors. The Leafs are the Leafs, and we know as much as he thought that he had fixed the Leafs, that's currently an ongoing process. Toronto FC was supposed to be Tim Lywicki's, his baby. He went into LA with the Galaxy, brought in David Beckham, won a couple of titles there in Los Angeles with the huge name. The big name was Jermaine Defoe. We all saw the marketing and the commercials before the season and the excitement and the first game, a couple of goals. Is this going to be the legacy of Tim Lywicki, a hockey team that is in constant state of rebuilding and has no real identity, and we don't know if it's good or half decent, but it's not great, and a soccer team that picked up two of maybe the top five players in the league and still couldn't make the playoffs? Is that what Tim Lywicki's looking at when he finally leaves MLSE when his tenure's done?
He built two ninth-place teams, I guess. the Raptors were a total fluke. They had Kyle Lowry at a deal to New York. Yeah. That's the rumor, and then James Dolan shut it down. So imagine if that team trades Lowry.
Mm-hmm.
You can't give him much credit for that. He did hire the general manager, so we'll give him that. But Toronto FC, everyone was talking Toronto FC. They got guys from Europe. Michael Bradley was there. The whole city was buzzing. The first game, even non-soccer fans were going, and everyone was talking about the Toronto FC. And the fact that they need like a miracle to make the playoffs, that's embarrassing.
Well, and what happens, because I think we all expect this to happen, that Jermaine Defoe will be gone at the end of the season when the transfer window opens up. The writing's on the wall. He's not going to play today because he's injured. Didn't speak to the media yesterday, and their availability before today's game. Seems like he's done. Is there a possibility, and it's crazy to even talk about this, how soccer crazy this city was when Toronto FC first came into existence, and still down there at the beginning of this season with the Jermaine Defoe signing and everything, there was a lot of palpable excitement. Is there a possibility that really, as much as Toronto FC is kind of a secondary sports thought in this city now, that if they lose Jermaine Defoe this offseason, we could really be looking at a step back as far as a focus on Toronto FC and a fan excitement in this city for that team?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that anything is going to happen in the offseason that will stir up the buzz that getting Defoe did. I mean, it's impossible, basically, right?
Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah, yeah.
Leo Messi. If you get them both to play.
You know what I guess that they're hoping for is it's the Rudy Gay situation all over again. You lose the one sort of superstar guy, but somehow the team coalesces and, you know, they get, you know, a few under the radar pickups that gel better. But yeah, it's
luckily that the beer's still cold down there, Ryan. Yeah, so you'll be okay.
And you know,
even if they lose this game,
and it's a great view. And like the thing is, I mean, unlike the baseball team in town, they've got this great venue too. That's like super fun to go to.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, just throw these people a crumb, you know, like,
yeah.
there's already the incentive to go down there because it's a active, fun crowd and a cool place. If you just won a little bit, it would really, you know.
Just make the playoffs once in the history of your franchise. But so far, not so good. But Ryan, you'll be down there having a good time, no question.
I'll find a way.
Gents, thanks a lot for this. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live. Coming up next, I've got an edition of Sportsnet Today. I'm Ben Ennis, along with Jeff Simmons and Ryan Dixon. Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.